Hello and welcome to USSOcast, a US Studies online podcast. Here we chat to PhDs and ECRs in American Studies about their research, their life in academia, and all things in between. I'm Will Carroll.
I'm Sarah Collier, and today we're pleased to be joined by Nicole Gibson. Nicole is an early career researcher in 20th century US history, specializing in urban housing, homelessness, and poverty. She received her PhD from Manchester University in 2020 and has a peer-reviewed article coming up later in 2022. So welcome, Nicole. It's lovely to have you on.
Thanks. Great to be here, guys.
So I guess we'll just start by asking you a little bit about your PhD research. So I know that you completed it in 2020. What were you studying for your PhD and what kind of direction have you taken that research after completing it?
Well, let me just take you through a few things. First of all, my research is basically about something called the third ghetto. Okay. And basically, the third ghetto is the emergency shelter system, which emerged in the 1970s, first as an informal network of local and faith-based assistance for the homeless, and then institutionalized by the late 1980s. What we had in Washington, D.C. was a crisis of new visible homelessness. And the solutions provided for this new homeless population were large-scale emergency shelters or welfare hotels and a series of assistance services, which I call the emergency shelter system. This system of assistance and the spaces provided to help the new visible homelessness of the 1970s and the 1980s, I call the third ghetto. Now, third begs the question, what was the first and the second? Well, you have to know, guys, that my research is based on the second ghetto thesis of a researcher, of a famous historian called Arnold Hirsch. And the second ghetto for Arnold Hirsch is public housing, specifically in his research on homelessness, on public housing between 1940 and 1960 in Chicago. Okay. Now, for me, looking at that research, I said to myself, okay, so given the trajectory of urban housing and the housing precarity outcomes of housing for African Americans in the 1970s and the 1980s, shouldn't the third ghetto be not a rehashing of public housing, which is the second ghetto, but rather homelessness? Okay. So my original thesis is that the third ghetto is not a reiteration of public housing, rather homelessness. The first ghetto in Washington, D.C., which is my area of research for my PhD thesis, the first ghetto were the slum houses behind the street housing for whites. This slum housing was built for first slaves in the 19th century and then became slum areas in the late 19th century and into the 20th century. These areas in Washington, D.C. were the first ghetto. Okay, so my research is basically founded on the principle of the third ghetto thesis. So that's it.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Nicole. There's a lot of really kind of interesting threads that I want to pull on here. I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about your kind of upcoming article, if you could. I know a lot of what you've just mentioned from your PhD thesis is present in this journal article. So if you could just talk about arriving at this article idea.
A long and winding road. That is the t-shirt version of my article. What happened? I put out the first version of my article in March of 2020. And the first thing, I know what you're thinking, bad timing, right? Because immediately, basically we're in the first throes of canceling events, the petite musique, the rumors of pending pandemic or just starting to come out. And so by the time, you know, my article is already submitted, there's, of course, all of the delays that go with that. But I did something else, guys. I made an important decision, a big decision, and that was, did I want to be right? Did I want to get it right or get published, right? And I went with my first option, which is I wanted to get it right. And I felt like everything that I just explained about the first, second, and third ghetto is nothing that you can get into, or I could get into 8,500 words. So going for a larger format meant selecting a different journal, which also meant that I had to reapply to another journal, which meant more delays. But I stuck with it. I said to myself, okay, we've got to, you know, hold on to your principles, do a better article, and just focus on the long game of your research. This is going to be your signature theory. You need to get this right. So that paid off eventually. And now this year, I just finished putting the final touches on the final version for publication. So it will be coming out imminently. And to find out which journal it's going to be published in, you can visit my Twitter site at Antaeus Argus on Twitter. That's a little teaser there. So my article title, just to give you a little bit more of a teaser, is called Making the Third Ghetto, Race, Gender, and Family Homelessness in Washington, D.C. from 1977 to 1989. Coming soon at a journal near you.
Thanks, Nicole. That sounds really exciting. And it's good to hear that despite the pandemic, that it has been, you know, productive, and that you've been able to convert your PhD research into an article. And I wonder, because of the constraints imposed by the pandemic, how has that changed your research methodology? Were you able to go to Washington? Were you able to make good use of any archives or interviews?
Well, I got lucky, guys. As I said, you know, I submitted my PhD early. I had my reasons for doing that, which we can get into later, but I submitted my PhD early in June 2020. So literally while protesters are out on the street, May 2020, and going this summer, I'm at home writing my PhD and getting that in June, which means that I'd already done all of the archival research before. I'd already done all the boxes and all that. All the old school archives we all know and miss so much. I did all of that before the pandemic came out. So I didn't have any challenges there. So that wasn't an issue. The issue for me, and here it comes, guys, were all of the harassment and the race crimes that were going on in my building, to which I was the victim of while I was doing writing my PhD and defending my viva. I had someone in my building who, well, just didn't like the color of my skin and let me know. And so I'm literally, while I'm writing my PhD and working on my viva, I'm under police protection. And I was dealing with this while I was finishing my education, while I was working with the police to build a case against my aggressor. I successfully defended my thesis at the end of 2020. So that had a happy end. And that case goes to court this year. So a little bit of structural racism there for you. So there we are.
Yeah, I can't imagine how, you know, difficult that must have been to deal with, you know, PhD thesis or not, like that is such a horrendous position to be put in situation. Just incredible resilience to defend successfully a PhD that you say, you know, you submitted early in the face of that. I think that's just extraordinary, really.
Well, it's a part of my culture. I was raised to suck it up and to not talk about it. We have conversations that you are not privy to because no one likes to see this every day. No one likes to hear about this. you know, I wasn't about to mention this to anyone, not even my supervisors. It was about getting it done, full stop. And then there's the after. Okay. The after is the PTSD from all the harassment, the heavy cortisol levels, the damage to my health. Right. Yeah. So basically what happened, I think more important battle for me, the PhD wasn't as hard as what happened afterwards, right? All of the hard questions that I had to ask myself after I submitted the PhD, and I had to look at all of this hard racism in the face. And so what I had to ask myself some hard questions. I had to ask, you know, what does it mean to be a Black scholar? And, you know, I feel like African-American scholars, you know, we have something unique to bring to the table as historians. We can and should claim our unique agency and relationship with the past, with our bodies, and our very personal connections to our heritage. So 2021 came along, and for me, 2021 was about prioritizing my health, and all of my decisions were gauged by this priority. Being able to put my health first meant accepting or turning down job offers based on my health choices, changing my diet and exercise regime, improving my sleep hygiene. Being in a position to put my health first was and is a position of privilege. It's a privilege that my parents didn't have as the first generation of African Americans coming out of segregation in public institutions and in the workplace. My parents had something to prove. They wanted to show that Black people could succeed, and their definition of success was intrinsically linked to professional and material goals. But their ambitions came at the price of their health. You know, for me, success is about being able to reach my full potential. How far can I go in my studies? How can I help my family and friends? Am I doing all I can for my mental and physical health? You know, professionally speaking, 2021 was a year when I was trying to do as much as I could, working on my research, looking for professional opportunities, which allowed me to protect my health while maintaining my household. Now, in 2022, I'm really excited about my professional life. I have this article that's going to be published. I am going to be working with the Race, Roots, and Resistance Collective. I have a partnership going on with the Global Urban History Initiative, and I'm going to be doing lots of really exciting projects in 2022. I'm also focusing on building relationships, engaging with other scholars and their research. 2022 is also about creating networks and building my intellectual and social communities. Professionally speaking, I'm prepared to move to where I can meet my professional objectives. Also, now that my health is back on track, I have a clarity of vision that has led me to ask some important questions about what I need and who is going to be able to help me get what I need. I'm also asking myself questions about what it means to be a BIPOC scholar. And these are crucial questions, guys, given the state of diversity and inclusion for BIPOC scholars in UK higher education institutions. For example, I ask myself, what are my needs as a BIPOC scholar? Well, I'll tell you what we don't need. BIPOC scholars don't need to be saved. We don't need white scholars to speak for us, nor for them to rage tweet about our predicament. We are not your project. What we do need are opportunities to amplify our research, opportunities to fund that research, and we need opportunities to earn a living wage in our respective fields of expertise. This being the case, I think that white British scholars need to learn how to speak to BIPOC scholars and not just about us. I think that the fundamental structural racism that exists within British higher education coupled with Brexit will isolate UK scholars into a situation where they will find themselves increasingly among people who look and think the way that they do. And many BIPOC scholars will leave the UK intellectually, physically, or both.
I think these are all extremely important points you're raising, Nicole. I mean, you've just sort of intimated the answer to this, but kind of contending with those personal battles that you've outlined as a PhD is one thing, but then transitioning into that slightly strange liminal professional space of early career research kind of brings its own challenges as well. And I guess, what advice do you have for people maybe transitioning out of that one stage into the next? And yeah, advice for kind of coping with that slightly strange, myopic place in academia.
Okay, well, there's some things to think about here. I think that it's important to understand the difference between PGR versus ECR life and to prepare for those differences. PGR students need short to midterm strategies to get through their research and to produce their thesis and pass their vivas. I did a podcast called Not Safe for Publication on May 6th, 2019, where I spoke about some of these strategies, such as compartmentalization. However, ECR scholars have to adapt to more long-term strategies, right? Such as creating an academic identity that they'll be able to develop and defend, using community building and networking skills. And another point I wanted to make that is important about ECR scholars is that they have to get used to frustration, failure, and rejection.
Yeah, so I think developing a thick skin is extraordinarily important in kind of the world of early career research. Absolutely. And thank you for sharing all that, Nicole.
Yeah, thank you, Nicole. And yeah, it's really sage advice as well. I think especially we have a lot of postgrads on the podcast, but not an awful lot of ECRs. So it's great to get some advice for the listeners as well. I suppose just moving on, you've touched upon your upcoming projects and you've got the article coming out as well. I wondered what are your sort of long-term goals that you were speaking about earlier, if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm really excited because 2020 is going to be an exciting year for me. So I'm going to continue my participation in the Global Urban History Project. It's a mentorship program for emerging scholars. I'm presenting a paper entitled Making the Third Ghetto Family Homelessness in New York City from 1970 to 1990. That's going to be organized by the Global History Initiative at Queen's University and the Poverty Research Network at the University of Glasgow. And I'm doing two book proposals, the first one being about welfare hotels, and the second one is a biography about my research assistant. Yes, so I went into the Global Urban History Project mentorship program with one project and I came out with two. So I've got these two projects that I'm going to be doing research on. Now, getting back to your previous question about research difficulties, well, that is what I'm facing now. So I've got my research assistant in New York literally going into archives and doing my, you know, going in and scanning the documents that I've asked him to scan for me. But we all know what's going on. Thank you, Omicron, because every move he makes, he's got to have he's triple, you know, double vaccinated and boosted and all that, all the bells and whistles. But the problem for him was testing. So over the holidays in January and December, there was this massive shortage in New York City, as you all know, of those rapid tests. And he just couldn't get into the archives because he couldn't have the testing done. So now he co-teaches at the new school in New York City. And so he has a supply a ready supply of testing. He's going to start being able to test at his disposal. So he'll be able to go into the archives right now. But I mean, it's touch and go, very touch and go on getting into archives right now, particularly with all these logistical problems due to our current pandemic. So those are all the projects that are going on. I'm really excited. 2022 is going to be a really exciting year for me. So there it is. I know on the list of questions that you guys sent me, you guys asked me about academic book recommendations. Guys, I want to talk about the importance of being a part of associations, if I may. You have to ask yourselves two important questions when choosing an association to work with. The first is, what is this association doing in the academic community, in my case, particularly for BIPOC scholars? And I'm not talking about those one-off PR donor-focused gestures, but real sustained support of ECR scholars, like mentorship programs and professional counseling. The second question you should ask is, what contributions can I make to my intellectual community through this association? You know, in the United States, I'm a part of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, called ASLA. I'm a part of the African American Intellectual History Society, and I'm a part of this Global Urban History Project. In these associations, I am either contributing blog entries or doing interviews or being mentored or being introduced into networks related to my field. You know, in the UK, I'm looking forward to continuing my collaboration with Race, Roots, and Resistance Collective. They have a Works in Progress seminar coming up in semester two that I'll be participating. So what you want to, you want the association you choose to work with you and for you. So that said, my suggested reading, all you listeners out there, is Nicole Hannah-Jones, The 1619.
I was going to ask actually kind of about these networks you're part of. And I think it's really important to discuss, you know, the associations that we choose to align our research with, et cetera. How did some of these relationships kind of come about? Was it through kind of conferencing and you know, traveling quite far and wide? Was it through kind of cold emails or social media? How are some of these connections informed for you? Because I guess this is something listeners might want to know a little bit more about.
Sure. Well, first, being a part of this mentorship program, that was, I applied for it. And I have to say, my mentors are absolutely fabulous, just constantly and presenting me with new opportunities, new ideas, and so forth. So that's, they're doing their job. And I'm really excited about all the work that's coming from that. But then I have to say, good old fashioned going on Twitter and seeing these events, seeing what they're proposing, and then, you know, attending some events and saying, okay, you know, and I like the scholars in this association, and they're supporting Black scholars, and they're talking about Black agents. They're talking, you know, they're reflecting my professional values back to me. They're validating my existence as a Black scholar. You know, I have to say, I'm going to drop this information because it's important. I did my master's thesis on my five times great grandmother, Marguerite Guillory. She was a slave who escaped Opelousas plantation in the Louisiana territories at the end of the 18th century. She escaped from Opelousas to New Orleans and worked on a boat and earned some money, and then had her used her freedom document, which was an authentic freedom document, had her children, her four children, extradited from the plantation, and she had them all freed with the law that was in place for a slave woman who was freed, who could therefore free her children as well. Anyway, so I did my master's thesis on this ancestor. Do you know that I was not allowed to mention in my thesis that I was related to this individual? Really? I could tell the story, but I wasn't allowed to mention that I was related to. So I have spent, here it goes, 5 years of my life in Europe studying and following the rules and being a good student, but also hearing, you know, what I can't do, what I can't say, you know, what's wrong with me because I'm not European, and what I can't talk about because, you know, that's a, I can't give you the translation. Let me see, what did my supervisor say? It was a banal family story, and therefore I should not talk about my relationship to my answer. No, that those dynamics will no longer stand.
Yeah, wow. It must have been unbelievably interesting, but also extremely difficult to be researching that family history and working through that pain, and then to be confronted as well by that level of institutional racism as well.
Yes.
It must have just been very hard.
Well, and that is why, getting back to your question, when I came across these associations that were not only saying, yes, it's okay to talk about your heritage, you must talk about your heritage, and it has value, and it is a legitimate and important aspect of research, a contribution to the intellectual community. So by all means, go find your family roots, by all means, you know. So that was a refreshing drink of water, being able to come home intellectually in that way. Please let me be clear. I have learned a lot in Europe. I am French, by the way, and by choice, I became a naturalized French citizen. I learned the language, I learned the rules, I played the game, and have been able to accomplish all of my goals. But there are some things here that you cannot provide to me as an African-American woman, because you don't know what those experiences are. You cannot have certain conversations with me. And while I was teaching at the University of Manchester, I had students come up to me, students of color, and we were having those conversations. You know, there were those moments where I had to say to myself, no, you can't say that in front of a white person. They won't understand what you're talking about. Put it this way, do this, say that, you know. And so I've had to learn to code switch. And I hope, and what I meant before when I said white scholars need to learn how to speak to us, not just about us, that means that you, if you want to have a truly diverse and inclusive society, you are going to have to learn how to code switch and learn how to speak to me and find out what is actually happening in our communities and what we're doing and what our hopes and dreams are beyond slavery and the civil rights movement. You know, how do we build our communities? What makes us laugh? What kinds of foods are important for us? Yes, we have food deserts, but we also have food culture. What is that culture? You know, we have a lot. There's a multitude, if I may quote the latest title of Stromae's album. There's a multitude of Black experience that I don't see reflected back to me here in the UK.
Thank you, Nicole. Some really kind of urgent conversations arising from this, I think. And I hope those that are listening will respond, you know, where this is published, getting in touch with yourself, with us as well. You know, these are all questions that need to be asked of people in our research networks.
I think that was a really interesting, and thank you for being so honest and frank in the conversation.
Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on, telling us about kind of your really urgent research, but also, yeah, that honesty and kind of candor that you've spoken about your own experiences and kind of finding validation in these networks that allow you to explore your own ancestry and heritage where previously that was denied. I just think all of this has been really, really eye-opening. And yeah, to have an ECR on the podcast for the first time and talk about these experiences, I think is great. And I'm really looking forward to publishing this.
Well, thank you all for having me. Thank you for listening to me. This is the kind of conversations that we need to be having. This is a part of my grocery list of things that need to improve. And you guys are on the right side of, are on the right side of my history, of what I need as a Black scholar. You guys are providing that here today. So I want to thank you for that. Yeah?
Perfect. Thank you so much, Nicole.